Hi, I'm Ashley Nichols.
And I'm Shamara Arkey.
And I'm Casey Boyd Swan.
We're podcasting from Northeast Ohio.
This is the Growing Democracy Podcast, a space to amplify multiple forms of knowledge, demystify politics, policy, and governance, and foster equity-centered civic engagement.
Each episode, we invite a guest or two to talk about what it means to be civically engaged, how engagement can be leveraged to dismantle systems of oppression, and how to grow a socially just and equitable democracy.
Welcome to the show, and thanks for joining us.
I'm really excited to have this conversation today about the two Shakers. And to start, I'm a resident of Shaker. This comes out in our conversation in a variety of different points. I moved here in 2016. And kind of to the point of many of the conversations we have about Shaker, I only know parts of the story, or I only knew parts of the story, right? The stories that people wanted me to know, right? Being a progressive white woman who's well-educated and wanted her kids to grow up in a racially and economically diverse community, right? Shaker was the place to go. They have all of these resources. It's kind of this progressive white person's dream for what, you know, it could be, what it could look like. But true to form, I'm also curious about histories. And so I started investigating a little bit more, asking questions about the spaces that I was living in, observing interesting, we'll use the term interesting. It's very loaded, and I intentionally mean it in a loaded way, conversations taking place in community. And I was like, this doesn't fit my worldview. And learning about a little bit about Shaker's history. So one of the kind of an article I think that captures some of that quite well outside of, you know, what Shaker is kind of come to, a lot of people come to know Shaker Heights, Ohio, because of Celeste Ng's Little Fires Everywhere. But in an article that came out in Cleveland.com in February of 2022, the author, and I'll name the author, Brenda Kane, talked about some of the history of Cleveland's East Side neighborhoods and Shaker Heights in particular. And so just so you kind of capture this, Shaker Heights, often just referred to as Shaker, had, like many suburban communities and many communities throughout the country, had racial covenants that excluded people that white communities did not want to have in their community, especially Black residents. And so there were racial covenants that excluded Black residents from moving in. Let me make sure I get this date correct. In 1948, the Supreme Court in Shelley v. Kramer struck down the use of racially restrictive covenants, right? So this creates this change, and people begin moving into spaces now that it is quote unquote legal, right? For all sorts of reasons, Shaker Heights being one of those places, and specifically in like the Moreland and Ludlow neighborhoods in Shaker Heights. And in 1956 in Shaker Heights, Black families began moving into neighborhoods, specifically the Ludlow neighborhood, and their houses bombed. And it sets off a series of kind of conversations within Shaker Heights, right? Around community building, around quote unquote integration, right? And so sometimes viewed as a turning point in this space, right? That's often the history that is shared. I think one of the things that is not shared are the ways in which the programs, the processes, the framing of this equitable space completely renders invisible all of the other systems that continue to perpetuate a two Shakers. And so I know I've been doing a lot of talking because for me, it is where I live. It is where I am in community with people. But, you know, I want to bring you in, Shamara, and, you know, you're also familiar with Shaker. You know, how did you come to know about Shaker? Because it's, your story is quite different than my story.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Like, how did I come to know about Shaker? That's an excellent question that I don't think anyone has ever asked me. Being born and raised in Cleveland, I don't think anyone's asked me that before. But I will answer it. And it's being, I can remember being in high school. I can remember at the church that I grew up in, the pastor's family lived in Shaker. And so there was always this thing about, ooh, they live in Shaker. And I mean, I lived around the corner from the church in Huff. So it was, you know, so that was, you know, presented to me as a young person that, oh, this is, you know, a place where different type of Black people live. But then in high school, I can distinctly remember I went to Cleveland Central Catholic High School. So in the city, on the east side, it was one of the cheapest parochial schools in the 90s. That may have shifted now. But so we had a racially diverse group of students there. And, you know, I can remember my classmates asking me where I was from because of how I spoke in particular. You know, that whole phenomenon in schools around talking white, acting white. This was in the 90s, the mid 90s. So that was kind of like at its peak. And we know because the research came out with Burley Daniel Tatum soon after that. But that was kind of like my first introduction and realizing that while it was one of those stereotypes or tropes that are supposed to be affirming, it really wasn't. You know, it was telling me that, oh, you know, the way that I expressed my Blackness was different than the geographic place where I was born and raised. Literally, I had lived in one house, 6915 Huff Avenue. I came home from the hospital and lived in that house until I turned 17. So really, really interesting and really got me to thinking about, you know, displays of Blackness, how we show up in the world, but then how we're viewed based on the affiliations that we have. So that's all. That was my introduction to Shaker. You know, of course, I was like, no, I'm not from there. Yuck. And so for me, it's always been yuck. We hear about this a little in the episode as, you know, we're hearing from one of the residents who talks about the traffic patterns and how, you know, you talked about the housing covenants. We also talked about the fact that as homes were built, they did not have porches or patios to dissuade folks from gathering outside, from sitting on the porch, right, or having a family function. We also know that the streets cut off. There is a certain neighborhood, we'll call it South Shaker, in the Lee Van Aken Chagrin area, where you cannot get between Shaker Heights and Cleveland through certain streets. You have to go outside of the neighborhood and then come back in. It's almost like a one-way in, one-way out situation. And so those are the experiences that I had learning about Shaker, being from the city, but learning about Shaker and interacting with other folks. And then as I began to become a professional, right, I learned about the school within the school, about the tracking that happens, particularly at the high school level.
So in this article on clevelandgut.com, you know, I'll use the quote. It says, you know, two inner ring suburbs, they're referring to Cleveland Heights and Shaker Heights, quote, which were founded as all-white enclaves in the early 1900s, stand out as national models of diversity. And I think this speaks to what I was talking about originally and part of my motivation for moving here, 100%. Honestly, this type of article was speaking to me, right? until I got here and started interrogating what that meant and everything that was rendered invisible with this framing. And the series of episodes, or this episode that has two parts, is really, you know, unpacking some of these histories, you know, and thinking about kind of the suburban histories and the contemporary experiences of the two Shakers, not that existed in a past that no one remembers, mm-hmm. but those legacies and contemporary manifestations that are taking place today, right? Not in 1900, mm-hmm. but in 2022. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, this might make us some enemies, but I think the conversations we're having are really important. So do you want to introduce kind of our first episode, or part one of episode 201?
Yes. So we will be joined by two folks who live, work, and play, and or play, I should say, in Shaker, Dr. Donna White and Ms. Tierra Sargent. Dr. Donna White, a Shaker Heights resident, has led a colorful life. She describes the life of her parents. Her mother was a pilot in the 1940s, a unique job for African-American woman at that time, and her uncle was a Tuskegee Airman. Her parents passed a strong work ethic and a belief in the value of education onto her. Dr. White describes growing up in the Mount Pleasant area and the fun she had with her friends. White attended OSU and stayed in Columbus after graduation. She moved back to Cleveland after 15 years in Columbus, moving to Shaker Heights in the 1980s. White became very involved with Shaker schools while her daughters were there, joining the PTA and eventually serving on the school board. Most recently, Dr. Donna White is a member of the faculty at Cleveland State University and also having served time in the Office for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. Our second guest for the day is Ms. Tierra Sargent, and she currently serves as the advisor to the Student Group on Race Relations, also known as SCORE, a position she has held since 2019. Last year, as DEI coordinator with the Shaker Heights School District, she worked with the executive director of DEI in organizing, coordinating, and implementing programs and initiatives that are aligned to the district's strategic plan. In her role as SCORE advisor, Ms. Sargent mentors SCORE leaders, helps develop and revise SCORE's curriculum, and advises over 250 SCORE members. She previously has served as lead facilitator at the Effective Leadership Academy, where she helped develop programming to give young people the confidence to make positive choices in their lives. Ms. Sargent has earned a bachelor's degree in strategic communications from Hampton University and a master's degree in positive organization development from Case Western Reserve University. All right, so good afternoon and welcome again. So I'd like to start with Dr. Donna White in this space. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your journey to get to where you are now?
Well, this can take a little bit of time. I'm a Shaker resident. I moved to Shaker Heights in 1982. I grew up in Cleveland, actually in the Mount Pleasant community, which is adjacent to Shaker Heights. So I was always familiar with Shaker. And when I moved to Shaker in 1982, my children were in second and third grade. And so I became involved in the schools. Professionally, my career was spent here at Cleveland State, which is where I happen to be right now, Cleveland State University. And I was, when I retired in 2013, I was the director of diversity and multicultural affairs at CSU. I have taught at CSU for several years and continue to be a part-time faculty member here at the university.
Thank you for that. I'd love to hear, what classes are you teaching these days?
Well, I teach, as I said, I'm a part-time faculty member and perhaps in a rather unique position because my academic home is history. So the courses that I began teaching part-time as I was continuing to work full-time in 2009 were in the history department. So I, you know, teach African-American history courses. Now here we are in 2022. I teach in the Africana Studies department. I teach in urban studies as well as religion. Right. Some of that just evolved over time. So one of the questions that I have often is, when am I really going to retire? And my, I'm very deliberately work in higher education. My career was spent as an administrator. And I pursued my doctorate at Case Western Reserve when my children had already finished high school. And so I had as a goal in my life to be a college professor, not necessarily full-time. And so because of the unique place that I happened to be as a person that people knew because of my administrative work, when opportunities or needs in departments other than history happen to come along, I happen to be in a place where people could approach me directly. And so that's why my portfolio is so broad. But all of the classes that I teach have either an African or African-American focus. So there are similarities, but they're very distinct courses. As an example, this semester I teach a class in religion and culture in Africa. I teach another course, Introduction to Africana Studies, which is the first semester, actually, that I'm teaching that class. I have an honors class, actually, that is debates in African-American history, which, and I'm in the classroom right now. They just left me at 2:20 today. And my third class is urban studies, and it is entitled Cleveland, the African-American Experience. And I, you know, of course, I like that because I can talk about my experience growing up in Cleveland. And occasionally, and not seldom, if I'm teaching that class face-to-face, they hear about Shaker. They hear about my experience in Shaker. So I have a pretty diverse, you know, teaching load.
Yes, yes. But thank you for sharing that with us. I want to audit one of those courses. So when I show up.
Oh, please do. Oh,
please
sure,
don't put me
absolutely.
Out.
No, I won't. Next semester, I teach a class on Ghana.
Oh, yeah.
Come on over.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll talk about that. Absolutely. Thank you. So next, we have Tierra Sargent. So Tierra, would you like to introduce yourself and tell us about your journey to where you are now?
Yeah. So I went to Shaker. I grew up in Shaker. My family's originally from South Carolina, so we really don't have family up here in the Cleveland area, which is a big part of our Shaker story because we really had to kind of navigate and figure out how do you work this system. And so we did have like some white peers who helped us, you know, see the light and see the other side. And so, which I talk about all the time in my professional work. And so I have a little brother, Jaden, who also went to Shaker. And so I think both of our two journeys combined really like fires me up about being the score advisor. But immediately graduating from the high school, I went to Hampton University, a black school in Virginia, which really nourished me. And because I think I really went to college exhausted. And so I was really able to get the nourishment that I need through my HBCU experience. And then I came back home. I actually got my master's at Case. And shortly after I came back home, I started working with Shaker as the Student Group on Race Relations, otherwise known as SCORE Advisor. So I'm entering my fourth year as a SCORE Advisor, which is really exciting.
Yeah. That's amazing. So I have a follow-up question for Tierra. Could you tell us a little bit about SCORE, what it is, how it fits into the Shaker School District and your role?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so next year actually will be SCORE's 40th reunion. And so actually we're going through the history of SCORE. In a couple of weeks, I do have a meeting with the founders to just learn more about the history. But we were founded by two people, Zachary Green and Marsha Jaffe. We usually don't hear a lot about Zachary Green, but they had a focus on like the creative problem-solving technique, but overall, they wanted to ensure that we were forming and sustaining Black and white friendships within our district. And so we do that by going into the 4th, 6th, and middle school classrooms. So really in those transitional stages of our district to encourage students to learn about people who might not look like them and to cross those social boundaries. And so we're really an education-based organization. And then we also go into, we have community events and we partner with various nonprofits as well. And so I work very closely with about 19 leaders every Sunday. And we do leadership training for about 3 hours. We get to know each other. Something simple as like food and facilitation. Someone's bringing dinner from their home and then they talk about themselves for 30 minutes. And then we go deep into activities related to race relations and then also just basic facilitation skills. And then those leaders then facilitate their own weekly meetings with other high schoolers. So we have about 300 kids in SCORE right now. And I personally think being a SCORE leader, being a SCORE member as well in high school, that the living room conversations are probably the most important parts of SCORE. Some would argue with me going into the classroom, but it's the first time that many high school students are interacting with people outside of their social bubble. And I think that's the beauty of SCORE because we are intentionally creating groups with people who are on the same soccer team, are on the same basketball team, don't live in the same neighborhood. So students have to cross tracks. They have to go into unfamiliar territories when they're going to these weekly meetings. And they are kind of forced to get to know people. And I think there's a beauty in relationships that are formed in the living room. And I know Dr. White's grandson is in SCORE as well. He was in my little brother's group last year. And I'm sure those two would have not known each other if they were not in the same group. Even though they come from the same demographic, but they're in two complete different grades. Jaden was a senior. He was a freshman, correct? A freshman, I think, last year. And so just even those small examples. Oh, a sophomore. And so just even those small examples of even within your own demographic, not knowing those people. So that's just a little bit about SCORE. Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you. So now I want to ask Dr. White. So in your introduction, you told us about the legacy of your work at Cleveland State University as the Director of Diversity and Multicultural Affairs most recently. And we know that you served in that role for 24 years. So thinking about the life of diversity, equity, and inclusion, being in that space from the early 90s, how has that space evolved and how has the work evolved over time?
Well, that's a really good question. I could go back even before that time that I happened to find myself in the office. I went to Ohio State University, and I'll say this very quickly. I went to Ohio State in the 1960s and graduated with my master's from Ohio State in 1972. One of the experiences that I had as I was working on my master's in adult education was that we would have strategies in some of our classes called sensitivity training. And I was like, oh, okay, all right, kind of kumbaya. You know, so I was certainly the youngest student in this program, and I was one of very few African-American students in the program. So I felt that this was an opportunity for students to, and most of the people in the program were professional educators. And so most of the people were in environments that perhaps were somewhat diverse. And this was an opportunity for people to learn mostly more about Black people. That was primarily what the focus was. When I was in graduate school, I also had an opportunity to work in Ohio State's Office of Minority Affairs. I worked in the, and Ohio State was one of the first institutions, predominantly white institutions in the country, to establish a Black Studies program, as well as an Office of Minority Affairs. I worked in the admissions office, but my supervisor was in Minority Affairs. And so so that was my introduction to what has eventually turned into DEI. Okay. I started off in Minority Affairs at Ohio State, you know, many decades ago. So I come to Cleveland State. I started off in career services, but then the office of the vice president for Minority Affairs was established here at CSU. And so I applied for the position, was hired to be, at that time, the assistant vice president for Minority Affairs. But then over time, that Minority Affairs became a definition of a department that started to become less popular. Universities started using multicultural affairs. I think Cleveland State, and I tried for a long time to hold on to minority, even though the term itself was not one that I was ever attached to other than in a political sense, that minority connotes that the problems have not been resolved. And so, and Cleveland State and any institution, can say that they have not reached, particularly in terms of student graduation, retention, and even in terms of how, faculty understand, how they interact with their students in class, in and outside of class, we don't ever become so skilled at that anybody says, well, we're doing such a great job that we got it. It just doesn't happen. So over time, our office name was changed to the vice president's office, and the vice president, Dr. Njeri Newell-Holm, who I worked with for 20 years, the vice president's office changed then to institutional diversity. We had always had an individual in our office, Dr. Melody Yates, who was the diversity training director. And so the use of certain terminology was, maybe preceded the name of our office. And Cleveland State also had a master's program in diversity management in the psychology department. Unfortunately, it does not any longer. And so we were already looking at, how does this, the designation of our office represent, we're doing also another aspect about the vice president's role was that for many years, the vice president was over affirmative action. So that really also gave her, her role real teeth in the hiring of, diverse, faculty, and to keep the institution informed and reminded of what, diverse staff and faculty really look like. My role then was, in the Office of Diversity and Multicultural Affairs came along with that. I really wrestled with the use of the term multicultural, because it, for me, meant that we were more program-oriented than we were problem solvers. And so now the office has a different name. So DEI did not exist when I retired. Okay? The department I was in was institutional diversity. That was changed soon after I left. We do have a vice president for campus engagement and diversity, equity, and inclusion. When I first started hearing the acronym DEI, I had to really think about what that meant. I was like, okay, Okay. And much of the language that is used, you know, at this point, the many people are just very, you know, familiar with the, you know, much of the terminology seems somewhat new, you know, for me. Now, I'm in the classroom, so unless I encounter students that feel as though they have to access some services on campus, I'm not in the administrative world, you know, that addresses concerns of faculty, staff, and students. While I did work at the institution full time before I retired, I was for 1 year the interim director of affirmative action. And so I really did get to see significantly in that short period of time what some people really wrestled with when they felt as though they were confronted with discrimination, and mostly on the faculty and staff level. And so this DEI world has evolved. I am one who does not necessarily believe that that it's necessarily going to address or confront, you know, some of the issues that I felt that we were confronting when a minority affairs office was established, because it was based on more a political situation. It was, and so that seems to be, you know, gone at this particular point. And I'm not in that world right now. You know, even though I am, I feel that because I had that experience, that I have a sense of trying to know who my students are and how I can respect each one of them as an individual. You know, the student body at Cleveland State is what I would consider to be perhaps more diverse than most predominantly white institutions. And it's really a benefit. And I remind this, you know, to my students to keep in mind the benefit they have being at an institution like this. You know, we have I'm not sure what the percentages of students are, but we have we're not a big campus, so people have to encounter each other, you know. And in the classrooms, clearly. And I like teaching undergraduate students because that's where they're most likely to be in a classroom next to somebody who's not like them. And so I encourage them and say, you're missing an opportunity if you don't communicate with each other. It doesn't necessarily have to do with the content of the class. It happens to be that you're in the same space. So that's kind of, I hope that answered your question. It has changed. It has evolved.
No, it definitely does. Thank you for
it.
Recitation. We need to know that. When I speak to my students about even the department that I work in, changing from Pan-African Studies to Africana Studies just within the last 2 years, names are very important. And names signal to us that turnover, they signal to us a change in leadership, change in thought process, so many different things. And unless we are tuned in to understand the reason behind the change, most often we'll miss it. So thank you so much for that. And even today, as you know, it's DEI, but you know, folks are bringing in their new letters. So there's DEII, right, including intersectionality, but there's also B for belonging and J for justice. So really understanding the pathology around naming, renaming, and in a sense, the work that we're doing. Thank you for that.
That's awesome. So I have a follow up, and I don't know how to build on this because I am kind of still reflecting on your comments around the evolution of DEI. But my question is geared toward Tierra, and in part, my question is grounded in this story that I want to share, if it's okay with you. And part of the reason that this podcast came to be, I was telling a story. My child happens to be a SCORE member. And I was telling a story about one of their experiences. And as a white student, it's been very profound for my child to be in these spaces and to do this work, and feels very committed to it, keeps showing up and wants to do the work. And I was telling this story in one of our team meetings, and one of our students, former interns, who had been doing a variety of work around recent legislation on anti-CRT language in education, and had been in those spaces, was like, that would be a fantastic conversation. Let's talk about storytelling and what the work looks like in higher ed and in high schools. And so all that to say, you know, Tierra, can you tell us how, you told us a little bit about the history of SCORE, but how does SCORE fit into kind of the bigger picture suburban framework of Shaker Heights education?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think in the past 2 years, we've definitely found our stance. And we've always been supported by the school district. So we're very fortunate to have that support, because I talk to many school districts and they're like, how do you get the support from your school board? So, you know, our teachers give up classroom time. They let the students miss school. So we are grateful for that. But I think our strategic plan that in our educational equity policy, the districts now gives even SCORE a little bit more life and a little bit more structural and sustainable support. And so in the policy, the fruit of that has come, we now have an Office of Diversity, Equity, Inclusion that has grown pretty quickly from the past 2 years. And so that just office support has really helped us, one, to be able to reach beyond what we have been traditionally reaching. So now we're relaunching our community events. We are going to be sending more mailings home to our students' families, just so that we can get our families on support. We have a great connection, and the connection is even becoming stronger over this next year with our Shaker Schools Foundation. So I think just that institutional support, it ties into our district's fabric. And I think that we will be critical in our district's work. And I say that because recently our district just decided to go back to another athletic conference that is not as racially diverse as the athletic conference that we're in. And so SCORE last year hosted a community forum about redlining in athletics. So it tied in how our athletic programs connected to redlining. I personally learned a lot of history just about like how football teams were formed, et cetera, and why we have segregation today. And so after that community forum, I think if I'm getting the timeline right, that's around when we announced we're going to go back to the GCC. So the Office of DEI, we then had a community forum with our community stakeholders. Then our superintendent also created this list and tasks that he wants athletics and DEI to really focus on. And so now we have a very strong focus on DEI and athletics, and we have an action plan as well. And that just shows like SCORE necessarily doesn't do advocacy work, but we are education based. So when our stakeholders are becoming more educated on these topics, we are organically putting more pressure on our administrations, and we're seeing change happen as well. And our parents are becoming a little bit more aware of why maybe things are like the way they are. And so even as we are talking about facilities in Shaker and getting new buildings and reopening schools, people have referenced a couple years ago, we just had a community forum on redlining. So even that and the impacts of redlining today and how people are thinking about oh, do I really want my school, my students to cross the tracks, or do I want my students to go to this certain neighborhood? And not thinking that mostly marginalized families in Shaker and the Mercer neighborhood, we travel. I grew up in the Moreland neighborhood. We travel to Mercer to go to our non-neighborhood elementary school that everyone raves about. So I think just us bringing awareness. And also, I really hope that the fourth and sixth graders are bringing these conversations home and challenging their parents' thought process as well. And so that's why we did start mailings last year. And this year, we're going to pilot the fourth graders teaching back to their parents, because ultimately, the parents have a strong influence on what happens after their child graduates from 12th grade. I mean, I say it many times, like, I am shocked by some of my fellow peers who I thought we were super close friends, and they had this diverse group of friends. But after high school, they hang out with all white peers. They were in a white sorority with problematic issues. And so I really believe it's your family structure, your family history and legacy that influence how you live beyond Shaker Heights. And so hopefully with these conversations and teachbacks and community forums, we are challenging and breaking family structures that I think will ultimately also influence how the district runs. Because in a place like Shaker, our families have a strong influence on the decisions that we make. And I know Dr. White could speak more to this, but even how our school board operates and who our school board is talking to. So yeah, those are the things I think our organization influences in an organic and an intentional way as well.
Excellent. I have a quick follow-up too. Are you still doing the podcast with the youth?
Equity.
I'd love to hear more, because so much of the work we do. Yeah, because so much of the work we do is around storytelling, mm-hmm. right? And so how all these different mechanisms of storytelling to amplify voices of the work that you all are doing with kids and podcasts, I think is so cool.
Yeah. So we, the district, so out of the office, our first leader was Dr. Jeffrey Ann Wilder. And so she started the Equity Unscripted videos on YouTube, and she was having various conversations with different administrators about educational equity. And then we, the communications department in our department, we decided to have a more broad and expand her work, really. And so we reached out to everyone. I think last year we had second graders on the podcast, which is super adorable. And we had one podcast, which two were my favorite, where we had some of our score leaders talk about dinner conversations. And it was very interesting because one of our score leaders, she's a Black female and her mother is a retired police officer. So her journey through that. And then another one is I have a biracial score leader, and she is being raised by her white sister and brother-in-law, and so their journey through that and dinner conversations. But probably one of the most powerful ones, and I was in tears, I was technically a guest during this, was we sat down with another score leader, and she was served as our, she did her senior project with the office, and we were talking about how we react to various events, social events in the news. And so myself and the score leader, we are pretty passionate and we get angry, but her mother and her twin sister, actually, they kind of just self-seclude and don't have an outward reaction. And we had a conversation and we told stories of like why we react. And I mean, it was a powerful moment because at the end you could really see like a Black mother's love and like the protection that the Black mother had for her babies, for her household, why she doesn't watch the news constantly because of the career that her husband's in. And so she would get anxiety. And then also how that protection turned to her protecting her community, and how she organically was like, I won't call her the neighborhood mom, but everyone was at their house. So I love the podcast. We started again, and our new leader, Dr. Lawrence Burnley, who serves now as the chief of DEI for the district, he talks a lot. You're going to hear him a lot, and you're going to hear the theme of inclusive excellence throughout the podcast this season as well.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you so much for that. So the next question I have is for you both, but I'd really like to continue the conversation with you, Tierra, first. So thinking about the history of SCORE and even these new initiatives, we know that SCORE is an out-of-school time program, so it's not a part of the curriculum. So I want to ask, from your perspective, being a student at Shaker and then going away and being a student at an HBCU and then coming back again and being a student at Case Western Reserve University, which is a PWI, right? So thinking about diversity initiatives in school, do you think they foster democracy? And if they do, how so?
Yeah, I do. And I do just want to add that the high schoolers are after school, but we are going into the school building for the elementary. So I think that goes perfect into your question. I think that organizations like SCORE, like I vividly remember my sixth grade SCORE visit where I was kind of formally introduced to maybe race relations. Like that was my first introduction because obviously being a Black woman, I live this life, right? And so that allowed me to educate myself on and ask my parents questions about like what was going on. And I think in sixth grade, my SCORE leaders, we were talking about like media and how Black people are portrayed in the media. And so seeing that, and now we do this activity, like a trust activity in the fourth grade classroom where the fourth graders kind of describe the level of who they trust and why. And so we have questions like their teacher, their family, but then we go into police officers or the president of the United States. And so it's a very interesting conversation to have with fourth graders, and maybe they don't know they're talking about democracy, of why they trust the government and why they do not. And also cultivating their voices and educating them on these topics so that they then can maybe intersect their voice with some of their passions of like the arts or podcasting or media. So I think it's very important. And I will, on the flip side, going to an HBCU, I think anybody, any school district could do a better job of educating and giving us our accurate information. Because that is, I really think at Hampton, that is where my voice was cultivated and refined, because I was being mentored. One, I was able to really reflect on what my history was. I was given accurate information, and I was also seeing Black professionals who look like me on a daily basis and who were going through the journey that I wanted to go through. I originally was I was a communications major. So seeing the Black communications professionals. And so then how do I use my passion in politics? So I did a lot with Hillary Clinton's campaign at Hampton. How do I use that passion over and over again? And so I think me knowing my accurate history gave me more fuel to contribute to that as well. So I think that we as America could do a better job of giving especially marginalized communities their accurate information. But I do think SCORE helps with people, especially the little students of understanding various social issues and then hopefully advocating for them there.
Awesome. Thank you. So really recognizing the
the most impact that schools and school districts can have is pairing these programs, is stacking them. So thinking about it being as a part of the curricular, co-curricular, and then also an extracurricular. And now, as you all are moving into family and community engagement, to really hone in on the message. Dr. White, what about you?
Yeah.
Do you think that diversity initiatives in schools foster democracy?
I would say yes. I would say yes. I don't think that they happen in enough school districts. Shaker certainly has a story to tell. And I do believe that there are probably initiatives in many school districts, but I think that I have the unique experience, of course, of hearing from so many students from so many different school districts that come to Cleveland State. And it's not unusual for students to tell me that they have never had, other than a chapter or a few lines in a textbook, about, you know, a topic like slavery. And so I know that in Shaker's curriculum, you know, there are African-American history courses, you know, whether, you know, elective, I would imagine, but it's there. That's not necessarily something that all students experience in the schools they happen to have attended. And so I believe initiatives are important, but I do know that that unless students perhaps are in reasonably diverse school settings anyway, those initiatives may not necessarily be priorities. And that is evident when students leave their schools and go to environments where they have more diverse experiences and feel as though, and I've had students say that they feel, one student told me that she was infuriated that what she was learning at the college level was the first time she was hearing some information. So Shaker is doing, you know, considerably more. You know, I say even so in terms of higher education institutions that have long histories of diversity initiatives. They are, for those students who get engaged, I feel that in a school district, you know, it's more likely that there will be more more students and families reached by the initiatives that the school district will offer than, say, a higher education institution. Because in a higher ed institution, there are people who will actually, you know, engage, and many, many, many students, faculty, staff can choose not to. And so, you know, in the experience that I had working in the, you know, in institution diversity, I always felt that we were really only reaching a small number of students. And we had very good programs. But when I thought about the total student body and attempting to offer experiences to students, a diverse, you know, representation of students, very often our following would be students of color. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't necessarily attracting students who were not students of color. So in that regard, whether students were not interested or we were just targeting the, you know, the audiences that we felt were more likely to be interested, because people want to learn about themselves. I mean, just like, you know, Tierra, going to an HBCU, you know, you're going to learn things because your interest really is to know more about, you know, where you are in the society. And certainly it does help for individuals who are involved then to go forward and, you know, and apply what it is that they know, you know, in whatever careers and, you know, workplaces that they happen to be. I think initiatives are useful and effective, but I do think that they are not necessarily, they don't necessarily have as many people engaged. And I'm talking about higher education in particular, other than, you know, students that may be in classrooms. One of the points that I do want to make at you know, about Cleveland State. And I think this is somewhat unique for you know, predominantly white university, has a history, a long history, really almost since the establishment of CSU in 1964. There are requirements in the curriculum for students to take courses in the African American experience. It is, and there was a requirement that students take two of those courses. Now that's one, and we also have a social diversity requirement. So in the general education curriculum, students cannot graduate from Cleveland State without taking a class on the African American experience. And so the classes are very diverse. There are many of them. There are many choices students have, whether they're, and the offerings are, you know, throughout the day and in the evening. So students never have any concern about whether they can, you know, get their requirements satisfied. Virtually all of the classes that I teach are gen eds, are general education courses. And so that's why I hear from students that it may be the first time that they're having some, you know, formal exposure to the information about, you know, African and African American experience. The African, you know, courses are in another general education category. So that I had not really thought about that until I came to Cleveland State, and I said, everybody here has to learn about Black people. That's, and students, there was certainly concern. Students, you know, had voiced concern many years ago. I, you know, haven't heard it recently, but students said, well, why? They were in the middle of Cleveland, Ohio. You know, significant population of African Americans have been here for a long time. And so over time, the curriculum was revised. So now there's one course required. But it doesn't necessarily mean that students have to limit themselves to just taking one class. You know, I have students in multiple classes of mine, and I know that it's not just because it's satisfying a requirement. But that's really, I think, a real reason, you know, for me just to tell Cleveland State story, because every student has to be in that classroom in order to get a degree.
That's fantastic. Mm-hmm. Our podcast, and I want to actually mention this as well. Last year, Shmara and I and a colleague, Casey, and another colleague, Anuj, at the time, had a small startup grant to focus very specifically on a series of podcasts on the topic of race and democracy. The podcast was, and all of the events we did were incredibly successful. And at the end of it, agreed, while Anuj went off and got a tenure track job elsewhere, and we are celebrating his successes. The three of us, Casey, Shmara, and I, decided that the work that we were doing as a kind of subset series would actually become central to all the work that we were doing. So the concepts and the intersections of race and democracy would be central to everything that the Growing Democracy Project would do, bringing Shmara on as the full co-leader on the project. So I say all that because, you know, our podcast really does ask questions around the intersection of race and democracy. And part of the impetus for this conversation was thinking about kind of suburban Cleveland, Shaker having its own interesting and complicated history and also amazing stories, right? So all these pieces fitting in together. And so my question is initially, my first question is for Tierra first, and I think Shmara has a follow-up question kind of on a similar trajectory afterwards. Shaker Heights is located in Northeast Ohio, just outside of Cleveland. So for all of our listeners across the globe. And it was recently made famous by the book by Celeste Ng, Little fires everywhere. I'm a recent transplant here. I moved here about 6 years ago. And the book came out not too long afterwards, and everybody was asking me about it. Like, is this real? Like, is this real life? And then part of me as a new transplant was like, oh, I see lots of this. Like, and then on the other part, knowing that, you know, complicating the narrative is really important. So my question to you, Tiara, is, you know, as a score leader, as someone who grew up in Shaker, left and came back, you know, what would you add to complicate or add to the narrative of the book, which really highlights kind of all of, you know, race relations and the complexity of living in a space like Shaker Heights?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's interesting that you shared your perspective, because everything that I saw in Little Fires Everywhere, I that was reality to me. But then I would talk to like my white friends, and they were outraged. They're like, this isn't Shaker. And I'm like, this is Shaker. So to answer your question, I think there's two different Shakers, and I'll talk a little bit about my family being a transplant. So I started Shaker when I was in first grade. And so we moved here. We moved to Pennington in the Moreland community, which is a majority Black community. We loved our neighbors. And then I went to Mercer, which is literally on the other side of Shaker. And so we obviously connected with some Mercer families and the Mercer neighborhood itself. And so my mom and my parents became very close with another white family. And so their experiences were completely different. We had completely different experiences. One experience is we don't track anymore, but we used to have tracking via test scores. And so in elementary school, students will get pulled out of classes. And it usually was all white students getting pulled out and Black students who were in the class, right? And so I told my mom that. I was like, hey, like, I'm staying in class. It's mostly Black students. I really don't know. I said that in whatever elementary language I could. And so my mom obviously investigated, and she was told it was my test scores. And so this comes up in a conversation that we have with our white family friends. And so our white friend goes like, oh, what was Tierra's test scores? And so I actually had the same test score as one of her daughters, and then a higher test score than the other twin. And so they went together to advocate for me to be in this pool out of classes. But if you don't know, like, I mean, we could have just stopped at it was the test scores. Tiara did not test well. But if we're not privy in Moreland to these conversations that maybe they're having in the Mercer neighborhood, which is a predominantly white neighborhood. And we in Shaker, if we're honest, we really do not cross social boundaries beyond the schools, right? We are in our pockets. Our community association teams are very segregated. And I think that is what Little Fires highlighted, the little pockets and the different experiences that we have in Shaker Heights. And that is really one thing that I would love to see that is different, because there is beauty in us crossing and going into different neighborhoods. Like, let's go into the Moreland neighborhood and understand the history, especially as we're doing facility planning. Let's understand the history of Moreland during this time, and let's not self-advocate for our neighborhood, but let's advocate for all of the students within Shaker. And I think that's where we miss maybe the mark in our community. Like, we say, oh, because my kids we're at Woodbury, the middle school, we're so diverse, but then I can go to my home and be comfortable with my white neighbors, my white soccer mothers, the PTO is probably the same. It's all of the same. And so are we really making an impact? Are we really making a change just because our daughter or son is going to a class with people who don't look like them? But what's going on beyond the classroom? So that's why I think sometimes in Shaker, we get frustrated and we're like, we always have these conversations, or we have this strategic plan, we have this educational equity policy, and like, what are we really doing? And we look at the institution, but then sometimes I challenge our community members, what are you doing to contribute to an anti-racist environment? What are you doing to make sure that we're mostly inclusive community? Because you can't keep on saying like, what are we doing? And you're going to the comfort of your home, your neighborhood, your soccer associations, et cetera, et cetera. And you come to meetings not really advocating for the whole district. You're really advocating for just your child. So that's just my little rant about Little Fires Everywhere and the two differences of Shaker. But I don't think everyone sees it. If we're honest, white people don't have to see the reality out of themselves, and they don't have to face the burdens marginalized people do. They have to intentionally research. They have to intentionally advocate. They have to intentionally work to be anti-racist. And that is hard. Like, that is very hard, right? So it is easy. Like, I could see as a white parent or a white community member why I go to the comfort. But if we want Shaker to be what we say it is, then we, especially our white community members, have to do the work and intentionally do the work. And I think sometimes even our community leaders, just leaders in general, might be too afraid to call out white people. But like, as a score advisor, I mean, that's my job, right? I can say like, hey, white people, we need you in this work, and we are not going to make progress if you are not intentionally doing the work. And I can tell my score leaders, hey, what is going on right now is not okay. Your peer is suffering in this living room. They need you as a white person and as a white ally, and you need to stand up, and it's going to be hard. And hopefully as their advisor, I can walk through them, process it, and walk through the steps. But like, in my role and as an alum, I will continue saying, hey, white people, we need you, which is sad. But we have to, I think that is going to be the next step of us progressing forward and us not having the same conversations. Because it is my desire, like if I do have children in the district, that I'm not having these same conversations 10 to 15 years from now. But it's a reality that I could be having these same conversations as well.
Could I add something to that? So my children's experience was very different. You know, as I said, we moved to Shaker in 1982, and we moved in the Moreland area. We moved in the Moreland neighborhood. And so my children went to Moreland Elementary School, which is now the Shaker Public Library. And I lived in Moreland. I live in Moreland now. And we had lived in Lomond for a short period of time, but my children's education in Shaker initially was all in Moreland. They both graduated from Moreland Elementary School. I was offered an opportunity when I enrolled the children in school to send them to Moreland. I didn't know the school, so I was like, okay, well, I'm in the neighborhood. My assumption was that there were 9 elementary schools. The education is consistent from one to the other, so I can send them to like any school and they should receive the same education. Okay. So I was offered this opportunity to send my children to a school outside of the Moreland neighborhood, at that time, Fernway, and, or I could send them in the neighborhood. That was an option to me because I'm Black. So it was a pro-integrative opportunity for me to send my children to Fernway. I said, isn't there a school down the street? And so I said, what's the racial percentage in Fernway? So they told me at that particular time, they said, oh, about 21% minority. I was like, well, what does a minority mean? You know, define it for me. How many Black students are there? You know, and then I said, well, what's the percentage of the school down the street from me where they can walk? You know, it's a neighborhood school. I want my children to have that experience if they can. That was one of the draws I had to Shaker. And so they said it was whatever, 90% or whatever. I was like, well, my kids are going to the 90% school. You know, if I have a choice, you're giving me a choice. I want my children to be somewhere where they will know they have the opportunity to be number one. Now, that doesn't mean that they will be, but in this society, the likelihood is, if they're in a significant minority, they won't know how that feels. I just want them to know how it feels, you know, so that they will in their lives know that that's a possibility, especially because they were so young. And so, so they were actually in a pullout program. There was, at that particular time, the elementary schools were like magnet schools. They all had some area that was an area of focus. Moreland was the math magnet school. So if your children, and this was what drew many white parents to Moreland. So the only way you could get this math program was if you went to Moreland. No other elementary school offered it. And I don't know how many African-American students were in the program, but very, very, very few. The percentage of the white families in the school was, you know, maybe 10% or less. But the students in the math program were significantly white. And here we're in a predominantly black school. And the students were pulled out of class. And my children, both of them, happened to be in that program. And so it was obvious, you know, to me, whether it was test scores or whatever, you know, factor was used to determine how students qualified for that program. It was just fortunate that my children were in it. It was unusual. It was unusual. So those differences, you know, were just very apparent, you know, to me. But the other opportunities my children had, you know, were that they were in this environment where they were around, you know, teachers who chose to be teachers at Moreland, mm-hmm. teachers who prided themselves in the achievements of these children. Mm-hmm. And I felt that at that age in particular, it was very important. So yeah. The children themselves to carry that, yeah. You know, it doesn't have to be the, you know, the parent all the time, you know, it's like, okay, my kids, regardless whether they, you know, were high achievers or whatever, they just felt good about themselves, yeah. You know, because everybody did. So it was unfortunate because, you know, everybody knows that the school closed. It's a conversation we still have. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a conversation we still have. You know, Moreland is a very strong, very stable community that many people who live in Shaker don't really know. Mm-hmm. You know, or whatever they know about the community. Maybe, you know, some things in passing. I remember being on a committee. I've been on a lot of committees in Shaker. Being on a committee with someone who had grown up in Shaker. He was, he was a professional person, lived in maybe Onaway or some area like that. And he made a comment and he said, well, you know, I understood that all of the houses in Shaker were multifamily houses. I'm like, how could he have grown up here? I mean, I was like, that's not true. My house is a single house. There are a lot of single houses in Mormon. No notion whatsoever. You know, about the different communities, because people get in there, you know, they come home, yeah. They associate with whomever it is. Again, you know, just like Tierra was saying, you know, it's very real. It's mm-hmm. very real. And then, you know, some people really look at Shaker as just a whole community and you're a part of the entire community.
Yeah.
But it probably is not likely that people know the whole community.
Yeah.
You know, other than kids come to schools together.
Yeah. And yes. I just want to make this like a full circle moment. Dr. White's daughter, Miss Hunter, she wasn't my math teacher, but she tutored me in math in middle school. And yeah. It goes to exactly what Dr. White said. In middle school, I was struggling with math, but her and this other black math teacher, I think they really took pride in Tierra getting to know what was going on. And they worked with me diligently. They worked with me before school. They did not have to be there before school helping little old Tierra. And I think even in my role as an adult now, I know that I can go to Miss Hunter for mentorship. I know I could go to her mm-hmm. for that advice. So even like back to one of your questions about like democracy and race, et cetera, even black kids seeing people who look like them in the classroom. And I think about like when I hear Miss Hunter talk about her Moreland experience, I think about what would my elementary school's experience be like if I went to a school like Moreland? Because it sounds like an elementary HBCU. That's how like they made it sound. So like, how would my experience in Shaker look different than going across town to a community I don't know? And I really have no culture connection to, because that is not where we go after school. So I think that, I mean, understanding our history is important, and especially as we are making decisions today, and honoring our history as well, and seeing the full circle of moments is very important.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And being able to, that representation matters. You know, we're talking about policies and programs, and you can have all the policies and all the programs, and they might still work, right? But when we are able to see ourselves in positions of power, that matters. When even you as an adult can recall in that situation and say, I understand that it was more than just about her being a math teacher, right? It was about the relationship that we're building as Black girls and Black women in educational spaces, and knowing that these spaces are spaces of radical transformation for us. And, you know, in a whole full circle moment, thank you for opening it up for me. I am, you know, just full being here in this space. I owe the work of both of you in my own personal and professional development. You know, I met you, Tierra, as a high school student organizing in an out of school time program. So they work. Look. Out of school time programs work. I am so proud of you from then, all the things that you've done to now, to everything that you're going to do in the future. Keep going, good sis. Keep going. Stay connected to people like Dr. White. Even my work in higher ed with the Ellipsis Institute for Women of Color in the Academy. We had our very first conference, and we were trying to make some calls to invite some folks to come down and sit on our panels and join us. And I didn't know Dr. White in that sense. Of course, I knew who she was, but I had never like approached her and had a conversation. And she so graciously accepted and has been accepting ever since. And shout out to Mariama, who also accepted all of our invitations. But that just shows how representation is so important to us. And not just saying that we're about it, but actually being about it and showing up for one another as we're continuing to do this work together. So thank you. Thank you both for the work that you do in schools and community and Shaker and beyond. Thank you for joining us today. And keep going. Good luck with everything that you have planned for the future.
Yeah. Thank you both. Thank you both. This is wonderful.
Yes.
I'm honored to be here. I'm really honored to be here.
Thanks for listening to the Growing Democracy podcast. Our podcast is edited by Jeremy Demery at Golden Ox Studio, right here in Cleveland, Ohio. This podcast is supported by the Center for Pan-African Culture and the School of Peace and Conflict Studies at Kent State University, with additional support from Mark Lewine and the John Gray Painter Program. If you like our show and want to know more, check out our website, growingdemocracyoh.org. If you want to support the podcast, as well as get access to behind-the-scenes content, live chat, and swag featuring designs by Donuts and Coffee, head over to patreon.com/growingdemocracyoh. Join us next time when we continue this conversation around growing democracy.